You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
we are all determined to restore peace and safety to the people of Ferguson, and I believe the continued resolve of the good people of this community will ultimately triumph over the few people bent on violence and destruction.
Missouri's National Guard is deployed at protests in Ferguson following the shooting of an unarmed 18-year-old. Zainia Wickett and Nina Schick will discuss the day's biggest news stories, including the events in Missouri, Ukraine peace talks in Berlin, and Julian Assange's announcement that he will soon leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London after having been there for 2 years. Then we find out why frustrated restaurateurs want to make you pay for your dining at high-end restaurants in advance. And we finish with a look at the most interesting new art exhibitions in New York. All that, plus a check-in with our woman in Athens, and music too. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So lots for you in the next hour on Midori House. But before we start any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Ukrainian military sources say dozens of people, including women and children, have been killed after a refugee convoy of buses was hit by rocket fire near the eastern city of Luhansk. Ukraine has accused pro-Russian rebels of targeting the convoy, but the separatists deny responsibility. A rebel leader said his forces did not have the military capability to conduct such an attack and accused Kiev forces of regularly attacking the area and also using Russian-made Grad missiles. Families are starting to return to the Kurdish town of Mahmur after Peshmerga fighters retook it from Islamic State militants threatening to split Iraq. The Peshmerga forces have now imposed control over the city following 2 days of fierce clashing with the Islamic State militants. Correspondents say the militants pose the biggest threat to Iraq's integrity since the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003. The U.S. state of Missouri has ordered in the National Guard to the town of Ferguson as protests continue over the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. State Governor Jay Nixon has signed an order to help restore peace. An independent autopsy found that 18-year-old Michael Brown had been shot by an officer 6 times, including twice in the head. The forensic pathologist is Sean Parcells.
He was shot at least 6 times. We've got one to the very top of the head, the apex. We've got one that entered just above the right eyebrow. We've got one that entered the top part of the right arm. We've got a graze wound, a superficial graze wound, to the middle part of the right arm.
The UN nuclear chief Yukiya Amano says he expects progress to be made soon in a long-running investigation into suspected atomic bomb research by Iran. There's a deadline of August the 25th for Tehran to provide more information. Mr. Amano was speaking at Vienna Airport after talks with senior Iranian officials in Tehran. He gave limited details of the topics under discussion.
We have started the discussion on the new practical measures that to be taken up as the new step. There were concrete discussions, but we cannot discuss which are the measures now. I hope and I expect we can reach agreement soon.
And the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has suggested he will be leaving London's Ecuadorian embassy soon. He said he understood from WikiLeaks spokesman Christine Raftenson he would be leaving the embassy after 2 years of refuge, but gave no more details. Mr. Assange is wanted for questioning over alleged sex assaults in Sweden and faces arrest if he leaves the embassy. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. And James will, of course, be back at the bottom of the hour with some more headlines from around the world. You're listening to Midori House right here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Way you London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24. fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And the time now in London is 18.05, which means it's 13.05 in New York and 20.05 in Helsinki. And joining me today with their take on the news here in the studio, I'm joined by Nina Schick, Director of Communications at the independent think tank Open Europe, and Zainia Wickett, US Project Director and Acting Dean at Chatham House here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, to kick off, we will look at Iraq, where the Islamic State's brutal rampage shows no signs of letting up. US airstrikes, now in their second week, seem to be doing little damage to this militia, and almost every aspect of this ensuing conflict has thrown up extreme political and strategic challenges. France has vowed to supply Kurdish forces with arms, and today Britain seems to be edging closer to military involvement, despite the constant no-boots-on-the-ground rhetoric. Saying, let's start with you. So not long ago that here in the UK, we had a kind of a debate about whether we should do anything to support, you know, Syria and the rebels in Syria. Now, this is, of course, a legitimate government asking for support here in Iraq. But what we were told at that time, that there was literally no appetite left with the public for any kind of military engagement in any of these conflicts ever again. Here we are without going to Parliament during a summer recess. We've seen a complete turnaround. Why do you think that is?
I wouldn't say it's a complete turnaround at all. I think you have to look at what the objectives are in each case, and the objectives are quite different. What Cameron said very clearly is the objectives are actually quite limited. The objectives here are to make sure that IS doesn't actually, the Islamic extremist group doesn't actually take control of Iraq, that the legitimate Iraqi government is able to actually push them back. That's what appears to be the objective. As a result, therefore, the actions are different. Cameron and the Americans and the French, for that matter, they're not talking about putting boots on the ground. What they're talking about is limited, targeted actions, whether it's giving resources, giving arms, giving equipment to the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces, or even at some point the Iraqi forces, or conducting intelligence surveys or conducting drone attacks on IS. So again, limited, targeted. What is different, and I think where the debate starts to get a little bit muddled up, is when people say, well, why aren't we solving the problem? You know, why aren't we going in there, you know, guns blazing to reinforce the Iraqi government and to essentially take back Iraq, in a sense? Because it's not in our capabilities to do that. And what you're seeing from both the Europeans and the Americans is effectively say, it's not in our capabilities to do that. So let's do limited things that supports a local effort by the Iraqi government that seems to be coming together
just
again.
Just before I pull in Nina, just tell me though, if we can't turn around the tide, if, you know, if it's not within our remit to do that, certainly the Peshmerga forces have seemed slightly disorganized, certainly not a unified front, and the Iraqi army seems a bit of a disaster. So it hardly seems to be within their remit to do this either, does it?
It's certainly within their remit. It's a question, I mean, it's a perfectly, perfectly valid question to say, are they able to do it? They're certainly not able to do it without outside support. But with outside support, maybe they can. And I think that's where the debate is taking place now. That's where you've seen this, what I would say is actually a fairly nuanced change from the international community, say, rather than do nothing or rather than supply non-lethal arms to the Peshmerga or to the Iraqis, actually the Iraqis seem to be moving forward in a political process that's a very positive one. Maybe that political process will actually allow people to come together from the various different ethnic groups, religious groups. Maybe that gives them more force. Maybe that gives them more energy. Therefore, they deserve a little bit of support. Support being the operative word. It's not the West or the outside, the international community trying to do something in Iraq. It's about the international community trying to support an Iraqi effort.
Nina, what do you think is pushing on this debate so fast over the last few days? You know, is it because, you know, Christians are being moved out of their territory? Is it because we look at Erbil and we say, oh, that controls a huge amount of oil that's of a concern to the West? Or is it just that we feel that these people are going to tumble into Europe as terrorists?
Well, I think it's a combination of everything. But I think the biggest challenge here now is to make sure that the political dialogue keeps on moving whilst the military front against the Islamic groups continues. And that's where it might get difficult, because I think the different groups in Iraq will see that as leverage, whether you're Kurdish, Shia or Sunni, you'll see that as leverage in the political process, not to come together to unite and fight these militant groups, because why would you give up your leverage? And that's where I think the West and especially the US will play a large role in making sure that those political talks continue, as we've now also seen with the new Prime Minister coming in. And I think that's where I think the US especially has a role to play in supporting and making sure that those talks proceed.
When we look at what there is to negotiate with, it's amazing actually when you look at the conflict in Gaza and between Israel, you realise how ordinary that situation looks. There is somebody to negotiate with. They have a list of demands. Here we have a group that doesn't even believe in founding a traditional state, that has a way of conducting its business, that there is no negotiations. What do you think is the best we can hope for? That we pin them back into a territory?
I truly don't know the answer to that. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. All one can do is say, you know, there are three or four options available to us and which is most likely to lead to a positive outcome. I agree absolutely with Nina that the real question here isn't a military question, it's a political question. Unless the various factions within Iraq can actually come together and create a viable political process that is inclusive being the most operative word there, then Iraq as a state is just not viable. It's not going to survive. And that's what the IS is able to actually, you know, break apart those fissures. That's what they've done incredibly effectively. Now, you've seen the Iraqi military partner with the Kurdish Peshmerga against IS. So, again, they've actually forced people to come together. You've seen a more positive political process that was completely stymied by politics, by Maliki, the previous or the current stand-in prime minister. You are actually seeing progress now. If that progress stops, everything's back to square one.
When we look at what's happening there, you know, cut to the world 20 years ago, nobody really outside of the Muslim world understood the difference between Sunni and Shia, and now it's a debate. Every single fight we see going on in the region is along these lines. Do you think that means it is, in the end, almost impossible to hold Iraq, Syria together? These regions, you know, they're following some lines drawn up after the Ottoman Empire. Do they make sense anymore, do you think, Nina?
Well, I think it shows that there's certainly no quick fix. And this shows, as what's happening in Afghanistan, that these countries are a complex fabric of tribal loyalties, ethnic loyalties. So it will take time. And I think, as Inya correctly pointed out, whether the new government is up to the challenge of bringing these different groups together remains to be seen. And I think that will be the key.
Well, we have a huge amount to get through today. We're going to move on to the situation in Ukraine. According to today's news, a convoy of Russian trucks carrying aid remains stalled near the Ukrainian border amid widespread suspicions in the West as to the contents of some of the trucks and firm Ukrainian advances against rebel positions. Russia appears at the moment to be biding its time. Meanwhile, as the battles rage on in eastern Ukraine, a legitimate humanitarian crisis appears to be occurring with hundreds of thousands of civilians trapped around the rebel-held city of Luhansk. Neil, let's begin with you on this. What's your opinion on why the West, in a way, didn't play a more clever hand than the Russians? You know, why was the West not sending aid to these cities and trying to kind of show that it also understood the plight of the people on the ground?
Well, as soon as Russia said they were sending this humanitarian aid convoy over, Kiev responded by saying it was sending its own over. And it's not fair to say that the West hasn't, because the EU has significantly stepped up support to the Ukraine throughout the crisis, financial support. But the interesting thing is now we seem to be in a kind of stalemate situation where the EU has amped up their sanctions against Russia to the so-called stage three broader economic sanctions. And Russia has responded as well by putting bans on imports of EU goods into Russia. So I don't see how what can happen aside from this uneasy stalemate unless there's more direct intervention in Ukraine. But it does seem to be that the Ukrainian army is now making significant advances in the eastern parts. They're making advances in Luhansk and Donetsk. So we'll have to see what happens. But certainly this is a question that the EU will be watching closely. And it's interesting also to see how Germany has continued playing its traditional role of mediator between East and West, trying to find a political solution.
Zenia, some of the shelling that's going on in these towns, it seems to be willy-nilly, maybe not a very military term, but it doesn't seem to be very targeted. This is exactly the thing that we were complaining about a couple of weeks ago when, you know, the Israelis were kind of pouring down shells on Gaza. It doesn't seem to me that much of a different story. And it's feeding into, you know, the Russian position, because, you know, we see images, you know, of children, of people made homeless by bombs just being rained down in their cities. They've got nowhere to go. They have no part in the struggle. They're probably ambivalent about who runs their cities. Do you think we're being a little bit easy on the Kiev forces? And rather than saying, actually, hold on, you're going to fall into a bit of a trap here if you're not careful.
I think there's two things to remember. The first is that, yes, there's no question that that bombs are raining down and they're getting civilians as well as militants. Equally, the militants, there's a number of stories, and frankly, one doesn't actually know who to believe, but there are a number of stories of the militants actually also attacking civilians. Lots of rebel forces who aren't actually behaving like soldiers, effectively, who are, you know, loose with guns. So, I mean, there are clearly abuses on both sides to the extent that one can tell. I mean, that's one thing to remember. The other thing to remember is, you know, let's get realistic about our expectations. You know, the debate that goes on again and again in Gaza, you raised it earlier, is that Hamas uses the civilians as, you know, a shield against attack from Israelis. So who's to fault, the Hamas or the Israelis? It's a similar conversation that you can have in Ukraine today, which is, you know, the militants are taking over civilian areas, who are living in civilian areas. The military, whose responsibility it is to provide security to its country, is only doing what it needs to do. Who's at fault, the military or the militants? What we have to remember is that our expectations that in today's world, technology is such that we can be utterly targeted, we can ensure that we're going to hit who we're trying to hit, just isn't realistic in these kind of circumstances. And it's one of the things that, if you look at NATO and what NATO's trying to do, NATO's really being wrong-footed by a lot of these efforts right back to the beginning earlier this year, where, you know, Russia wasn't playing by the rules. You know, Russia was quite happy to, as it currently is, to conduct exercises along the border with Ukraine that allows it to then move very, very quickly into Ukraine if it so desires, as it did in Crimea. That's not according to the rules. It takes weeks for NATO to step up and to stand up its forces. Well, days to weeks, depending on who you talk to. But the point is that we have these expectations. These expectations aren't being met. And so therefore, we're actually coming out and blaming people for various actions. What we actually need to do is get a lot more realistic about what is possible, what isn't possible, and maybe stop assigning blame quite so readily.
When we look at, you know, the two battles going for the two cities, Luhansk, already there are claims that the Ukrainian forces have raised the Ukrainian flag there. If they take that city, do you think the Russians are poised to come across the border? Why have they dithered? Do you think that they're thinking, actually, maybe this is a battle we shouldn't get involved in anymore?
Well, I don't think you can blame the Ukrainian military for trying to regain control of its own sovereign territory. I think from that perspective, their mission in eastern Ukraine is justified. And certainly Russia hasn't, well, as the West claims, Russia hasn't done enough to close down that border between Russia and Ukraine. And you've seen the movement of military equipment and pro-Russian separatists going across that border. So I think certainly the Ukrainians have, you know, the right to be there and to continue their offensive there. And sadly, there will be civilian casualties.
It's just the good and bad of these things. It's always worrying that we all fall into the trap of there's a good side or the bad side. Well, I don't think we in this room, we're debating a bit more, but the media coverage always seems to be there's a good guy and a bad guy. And I'm not sure that always helps, Zania.
Yeah, no, I don't think it does. I mean, I think to your question, one of the worrying things as I look at it is, you know, if the Ukrainian forces do continue to show a positive offensive and really take back the regions, what will Russia do? We know that Russia has approximately 40,000 plus or minus troops sitting on the border. This would be huge loss of face to Putin. Not just loss of face, but he started this operation in order to ensure that Ukraine stayed unstable on his borders. Now, what does Russia do if it looks like Ukraine is regaining its stability, regaining its legitimacy, regaining its control over its sovereign state. So I think there are a lot of people, myself included, very, very nervous to see what Russia's response is going to be, assuming the Ukrainian government is able to continue to show the advances it has.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Xenia Wickett and Nina Schick. When we return, we'll shift our gazes to Missouri and ask also why Europeans are so pessimistic and Americans so optimistic when it comes to addressing income inequality. Well, stay tuned.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Xenia Wickett and Nina Schick. We turn now our attentions to the United States and to the St. Louis neighbourhood of Ferguson, Missouri, where more than a week ago, Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was shot dead by a policeman. The shooting has led to widespread protests across the US, with demonstrations blocking the streets of Manhattan, for example, over the weekend. As city police units crack down hard on gun-related crime in many other cities, there's also a fear of resurgence of violence in places like Chicago, and many are asking if city police departments are becoming more like urban militias. Again, the issue of race seems to be on the front pages of all the US papers. Xenia, when we look at this story, it's a little bit almost like the story today with Ukraine, the shooting of this convoy. Everyone's made up their mind. The story is, has been told before we even really get the facts. America has divided along race lines. It's a terrible throwback to America of the 50s. There seems to be, we don't know what the right and wrong is here, but just the division within the US, you forget how stark it is along racial lines.
You really do. But I mean, I wouldn't even say along racial lines. I mean, I've got lots of, I know lots of friends, lots of people out there who are white, who are coming down on the side of saying this is thoroughly unjust. So it's not a racial division so much. But as you said, it's the black and whiteness, if you will, of this that is so disturbing. And through it, you've lost the conversation that we really should be having, which is, how should the police respond to events like this? How quickly can they raise? Do they have the right training? Do they not have the right training? Yes, there's a huge racial question that we should be asking, but we're not actually even asking that question anymore. We're just responding to the violence on one side or the other side, and losing sight of the fact that both sides actually have some legitimate questions to ask, and neither side appear to be letting the evidence come to the fore. And of course, like so many cases, the moderate middle, if you will, is being silenced through this process.
Nina, when we look at what's happened over the past few days, we've seen the troops being called onto the streets of Ferguson. You see, the dogs there. It looks like something out of the civil rights era. Again, we don't know what really happened in this case, and there are many theories. Whether what this young man had been involved with earlier that evening. But it does seem that everybody agrees that he was unarmed. And it's kind of the response to seeing a youth like that in the street that kind of defines this story. What do you think it tells us about contemporary America?
Well, I think that the police force, certainly it seems from what we've heard so far, was perhaps too heavy-handed, because as soon as the story came out that this young teenager had been killed, the police released CCTV footage of him apparently stealing cigars from a store as if that were in some way to justify his killing. And then when there were protests, which were largely peaceful, by the way, the riot police came out with rubber guns and dogs, which seemed like a very disproportionate response to a peaceful protest. So it's no wonder that people are angry. And of course, this is a racial question as well. So I think, as Zenia correctly pointed out, it does raise a larger question of to what degree does the police force have the right to police society like this?
And then you also, when we look at what happens in these instances, you know, Al Sharpton's there in like 5 minutes. It feels these things have a kind of no hope of finding a middle ground, because on both sides there are people who are very good at kind of drawing up the barriers. Do you think that going forward there's much that will come out? You know, it's extraordinary. We have, you know, a black president sitting in the White House, but it makes no difference, it seems, to many of these people's lives on the ground.
I think that what this is a phenomena that we're seeing again and again and again, which is these, you know, this in-group, out-group behavior. If you're not with us, you're against us. You know, and this is happening in the political field, you know, Democrats versus Republicans, anything they want must be bad, you know, and then the switch over, this is happening racially, this is happening, you know, we're having far more conversations today, both good and bad ones, about gender. You know, the newspapers 6 months ago were full of gender and technology, and why is it that women don't survive in the technology? You know, I mean, all of these conversations, we're becoming so much more polarized. Particularly in the United States, there's a question of whether the media has a role or a responsibility to play in this as well, you know, and that moderate middle is being squeezed out, is being found to be unacceptable. I used to say in the States that I'm nonpartisan, and I used to have people looking at me going, so you're just a wuss then, if you're not willing to, you know, I mean, it's that sense of just, you're not allowed to be temperate. In the United States, that's also, you see it here as well, and this is a horrible example of it, but nevertheless it is yet one more example.
I'm sorry, we're going to try and jump through two more topics in the next 4 minutes. Let's jump to Julian Assange. He's announced today that he will soon be leaving the Ecuadorian embassy, where he's lived in London for the past 2 years, where he went to avoid being extradited potentially to Sweden to face a trial there potentially on an issue of sexual harassment. Now, has he lost the public sympathy, Nina?
Oh yes, I think certainly. I mean, if he is innocent as he claims to be, then you know, he should just face the music, go to Sweden, and I think he will get a fair trial in Sweden. I think that's fair to say. I mean, the other point is that he's been there holed up in the embassy for 2 years, a great cost to the taxpayer in the UK. So I don't think he's done anything to endear himself when the government foots a £6 million bill to keep constant watch on the Ecuadorian embassy.
Zenia, freedom fighter, or actually just a pain in the butt?
It's not quite the expression that I would have used necessarily, but I agree with Nina. I mean, I think there's very, very little sympathy for him. And I have to say, with my little skeptic's hat, I wonder whether he just hasn't had enough press recently. So this is the latest. There doesn't seem to be any meat to this story.
Well, quickly, we're going to finish with this story, which is a new report by the Cologne-based IW Economic Institute that's found that Europeans think their societies are less equal than they really are, and Americans think their society is more equal than it actually is. Nina, what do you make of this?
That's very interesting, isn't it?
This is to do with pay. we're actually apparently less, you know, we think we're less equal in Europe, but we're actually a bit closer than we thought.
Perhaps that has something to do with, you know, and perhaps there's some truth here in cultural stereotypes. The American is always seen as optimistic, you know, clinging to that American dream, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And perhaps that's the thing that's pervading through in this really interesting study. And also, perhaps no surprise that the Europeans tend to be more pessimistic. It's been years of hearing about the Eurozone crisis, you know, falling wages, unemployment. So perhaps no surprise that Europeans think they're actually worse off than they actually are.
Zenia, do you think that, you know, two or three, well, maybe rather 8 or 9 years of headlines about bankers' pay, for example, has kind of informed this feeling that, you know, we're miles apart, when actually down on the ground it's a bit different?
Well, I think what the study shows that there is like so many others, like Piketty's book, you know, there is vast amounts of inequality. I think what's interesting is a point that Nina made in passing, which is, you know, the idea in America that still remains about social mobility, about being able to climb from the bottom to the top, which I don't think is present here in Europe. And that is no doubt playing into some of these results. It's not about inequality that we care. It's about, can you actually change your status?
Well, Anita, last point.
Yeah, it's also interesting to see that those countries which are actually more equal, like Germany and France, think that they're worse off than those countries in Europe which are actually worse off, like the UK.
Numbers and reality, we can't quite bring them together. Well, we can on this show. We're going to have to leave it there. But that was Zanya Wicket and Nina Schick. Thank you both very much for joining us here today on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in on the biggest discussion topics in Athens. We're going to review and preview some of the most interesting art exhibitions in New York. And we ask whether you should be made to pay for your fine dining experience even before you arrive at the restaurant. Before we get started on any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the World News headlines.
Ukrainian military sources say dozens of people, including women and children, have been killed after a refugee convoy of buses was hit by rocket fire near the eastern city of Luhansk. Ukraine has accused pro-Russian rebels of targeting the convoy, but the separatists deny responsibility. Families are starting to return to the Kurdish town of Mahmur after Peshmerga fighters retook it from Islamist State militants threatening to split Iraq. The Peshmerga forces have now imposed control over the city following 2 days of fierce clashes with the Islamic State militants. Correspondents say the militants pose the biggest threat to Iraq's integrity since the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003. The US state of Missouri has ordered in the National Guard to the town of Ferguson as protests continue over the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. State Governor Jay Nixon has signed an order to help restore peace. The UN nuclear chief, Yukiya Amano, says he expects progress to be made soon in a long-running investigation into suspected atomic bomb research by Iran. There's a deadline of August the 25th for Tehran to provide more information. And the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has suggested he'll be leaving London's Ecuadorian embassy soon. He said he understood from WikiLeaks spokesman Christine Hrafson he'd be leaving the embassy after 2 years of refuge, but gave no more details. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18.32, which means it's 21.32 in Moscow and 14.32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in on the local discussion topics in one of our home cities of Monocle's correspondents. And today we're heading to Athens, where Natalie Savarakis is ready with the week's top stories. Natalie, we're going to start with... we're going to start with some fruit. Tell us all about the Greek position regarding the ban on fruit being exported or imported rather to Russia.
Well, it seems that the Ukrainian crisis with Russia is taking proportions, affecting severely the Greek fruit producers. After the European decision to impose a sanction against state-owned Russian financial institutions, namely banks, Russia has, retaliated by saying, well, we're not going to import any of our fruit from European countries. And Greece, unfortunately, exports 50% of all its peaches and nectarines to Russia. So they've been severely hit by the latest Russian decision to do so, with tens of thousands of tons now being stuck in refrigerators or even remain uncollected from Greek orchards. And that's extremely painful in a country that is just barely recovering or allegedly recovering from a severe financial crisis and recession. So the European Union has promised Greece and the authorities and the fruit producers that it would try somehow and pay them, compensate them on these huge losses. But the decision remains to be seen. Europe is expected to decide on this in the following days, on the 22nd of August, actually.
And there's no kind of plan from the Greeks on what they might do, or new markets, or how they might turn the situation around. You know, there's no view from Athens on what can be done.
Well, no, and that's very much, you know, the predicament they're in. I mean, this was this is the season. This is when they're meant to be exporting these. All these arrangements have been made already. So they're desperately trying to look for a decision. Now, Europe, in turn, has said that they're willing to grant like dozens of millions to try and alleviate the Greek fruit producers from this this very painful like situation they're in. But it remains to be seen what exactly will be done. And of course, how long these sanctions will remain in place. And as you say very correctly, they will have to look for alternative markets if this persists.
Now, the temperatures in Greece I've been noticing over the last few days have been extremely high, 36s, 37, 38s even. It's dropped slightly, but I know that there's a big concern, isn't there, about fires at the moment?
Absolutely. I mean, this is like this recurring nightmare that Greece has to face, really. Of course, 2007 being the biggest one of all, when like wildfires that blazed throughout the country cost the life of over 80 people. And so, firefighters are definitely on alert. Just over the weekend, we had like hundreds of fires that broke out throughout the country, especially in the west of the country. Luckily, not close to inhabited areas, but everyone is on high alert because especially today, they expected big fires to break out. August is by far the most dangerous month because of the Greek wind, the Meltem, which is known to just compound the winds and make the entire situation worse. So everyone is on high alert. So far, nothing has been reported, but for the rest of the month, it's going to be a big headache for authorities here to try and control the wind, the fires that are breaking out throughout the country.
Now, it's rare that a story about Alexander the Great makes the front pages. He's still making news, it seems, though, in Greece. What's happening about this, then?
Oh, my God, this is a huge excitement. Even the Prime Minister has flown to northern Greece. There's this ancient tomb that has been found, and the lead archaeologist on this, Katerina Peristeri, is telling everyone that this is a tomb that is dated shortly after Alexander the Great's death. So there's a great excitement. We still don't know whose tomb this could be. Obviously, we haven't found Alexander the Great's tomb yet, so the Greek archaeologists are really excited, and there's a lot of commotion here in Greece that might this be when Alexander the Great was transported back and buried in Greece from Asia. Of course, we still don't know. This could take several weeks until we actually find out. The entire process and excavation works are taking their time, but Prime Minister Antonis Samaras himself flew there earlier this week, and it just hyped the entire thing up. So,
Natalie, can I just jump in? What I'm intrigued to know, the Prime Minister flying there, you know, the political story still surrounding Alexander the Great. We ran recently a story on the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which caused, you know, every time we run a story about it, you know, you will get letters from Greek people pointing out this is, you know, this country shouldn't exist, this country shouldn't have this name, etc. And bringing in always the story of Alexander the Great, that he was born, where he was born, etc. Is there still a kind of a political agenda around Alexander the Great, a contemporary political agenda?
Yes, very rightly said and pointed out, actually. There is totally a political agenda about this. And of course, Alexander the Great, as was allegedly born in Pella, which is very much still in Greece, in the Greek side of Macedonia. But of course, this name dispute rages on. Like decades later, we still have this. Decades after Macedonia, the country, declared its independence and decided its name would be such, provoking much anger here in neighboring Greece. So yes, this will definitely be high on the Greek conservative government's agenda, especially as it does try to, you know, ride the nationalist wave, because unfortunately, or, you know, it does need to, it's been trying to steal many voters from the far-right extremist neo-Nazi group Golden Dawn, which does use this very strongly, the nationalist card. And this is something that Antonis Samaras also would like to say and to use as well. So you very rightly pointed it out that if this, you know, any link to Alexander the Great will kind of also remind Greeks that, you know, their proud heritage, etc., and will be some sort of mini success for Antonis Samaras, the Prime Minister, amid a very turbulent period for himself when, you know, his popularity has been falling.
Natalie, really great speech to you as always. That was Natalie Savarakis with news that Alexander the Great is going out on the campaign trail. He's wearing a nice rosette for the Conservative Party, apparently. Well, that's kind of the truth. Anyway, up next, we're going to find out why frustrated restaurateurs may ask you to pay for your fine dining up front. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, restaurant entrepreneurs the world over are becoming increasingly frustrated in recent months as table reservations become the subject of fierce speculation and even underhand trading. The issue is not just customers booking multiple tables at different restaurants, only to cancel most of them at the last minute. Now reservations have become commodities. This summer has seen an upsurge of alternative restaurant booking systems that allow people to sell and buy reservations without ever letting the restaurant know. Joining me now on the line to discuss this further is restaurant industry journalist and food critic Bruce Palling, who's written about this trend and much, much more indeed. Well, Bruce, let's start with what's happening. So can you explain to us why the restaurateurs are really kind of getting a bit upset about all of this?
Well, I think the main reason is that the no-shows are a significant impact on their profits, because 15% of many leading restaurants' bookings sort of go wrong in the last 24 hours, 48 hours. And some restaurants, like Daniel Patterson, two-star Michelin in San Francisco, said he turns over more than half of his reservations in the final week before people appear. So it makes it really difficult to get your ordering right and people happy if you have these uncertainties right up to the moment you start service.
Now, I see that one of the ideas is that instead of allowing you to buy, rather than allowing you to make a reservation, the idea is that in future some restaurants are trying a thing where you buy a ticket to have a seat in a restaurant, a bit like buying a ticket to go to the theatre. You pay everything up front, and if you don't turn up, bad luck, your money's gone.
Absolutely. I think that sounds shocking to begin with, but when you think of it, it's exactly what happens if you don't turn up to the opera. Or a play, that's it, you've lost your money. At this stage, it's an early early phase. So there may be opportunities to get your money back if you can find someone else on Facebook or Twitter or something like that. They're going to be flexible, I think. But it does also mean that you don't waste all your time in hiring reservation staff to tell people all the time, sorry, we're booked out. This also doesn't help in relationships with clients. So I think there's a lot to be said for doing it at a very high end, not at ordinary restaurants, because that's not really going to help them much.
Bruce, can I ask you, in a moment we'll be bringing in Marcus, who's our food critic here in London, but can I ask you, I wonder if there's a bit of a breakdown in the relationship between customer and restaurant, because I know that in London, sometimes when you try and go and book a restaurant, you know, you're told, yes, you can come at 6 o'clock for 30 minutes or you can come at 10 o'clock for 30 minutes. You know, it's like you're pushed around, you know, the schedule as though or you're told, oh, no, we don't have a restaurant booking on that day, but if you would like to come in 2 months' time, we have something. And there's, I wonder whether in the end clients think, well, customers think, I don't care if I book lots of restaurants and cancel them at the last minute. You know, I'm treated badly. Why should I care about it?
Well, I think that's an issue that is real, because often the trick is they'll book you in at 7:30, but there's no table at 8:15, so you end up spending 50 quid at the bar. It doesn't make for a good relationship. But I think a lot of restaurants do rip you off in that way, and the ticketing thing makes it harder to do that, because you've paid your money up front, you demand your seat, just like you wouldn't expect to go to a play and have it start half an hour later than expected. So I think it also enhances the relationship between the customer and the restaurant if there's a sort of deal done in advance, so that there's a proper working relationship for it.
Marcus Hippie, who's the presenter of the menu, our food show here on Monocle 24, is in the studio as well. Marcus, when you look at what's unfolding here, do you feel some sympathy for the restaurants, or do you think that actually they're getting a little bit kind of carried away with their concerns?
I do feel a lot of sympathy for restaurants when it comes to this problem, in particular cancelling last minute. As an example, I'd like to talk about this restaurant. So I know in Helsinki, he's got a very small place with space for 12 people or so for one dining. And he tells me stories that every now and then there are groups of business people, so forth, booking tables from four restaurants. He actually hears someone else has got a similar booking as well. And then they just get cancelled and these people don't show up. They don't always even tell that they're not going to come there. And when you think of life of a smallish entrepreneur, small-scale entrepreneur, when it comes to these big losses, we're talking about money. We're talking about actually losing a fair bit of his income. Another thing I've been thinking about is when it comes to this new phenomenon of actually selling restaurant reservations, I don't approve with this at all, actually. I think maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I do like the romantic idea of actually having to work a bit in order to get your reservation. Don't you think it's really nice that you have been going to the same restaurant for a long time. You've actually established a relationship with the people working at the restaurant, and they can probably help you to get a reservation a bit easier.
Yeah, I think that's an important relationship. Actually, Bruce, let's just bring you back in on this element. This idea that you sell tickets to places. Well, the truth is that most restaurants kind of, as Marcus says, they want to look after a few kind of reliable customers, and they would like to also socially engineer that dining room a bit to make it exciting, the right kind of crowd, to have a kind of buzz. If they end up just letting you buy tickets off like a Ticketmaster machine by looking at, on a website, and they don't know who you are before you arrive, doesn't that kind of break down the kind of atmosphere, the buzz of going to a great restaurant?
Absolutely, it does. I think Marcus is correct to recoil at the idea of paying a premium to get into a restaurant. But you must remember that with this ticketing service, particularly the one that Nick Kokondas at Alinea in Chicago has developed, allows you to be totally flexible. So you can actually determine how many seats are on the system and keep back ones for your regulars or for your friends. So you don't have to put everything up and available. This is what happens with prestigious hotels. They never, ever allow anybody just to turn up because they want their regulars to be looked after. and there is flexibility to do that. The other major advantage of the ticketing service is you can actually charge less on, say, a Monday lunch than on a Sunday evening, so that you can actually get value for going at an uncomfortable time for the fashionable people. So that is a major advantage, which I think comes with a flexible ticketing system.
Maybe they'll even charge less for kind of, tables further away from the kitchen or without a good view. Marcus, finally, there was another trick that I saw in this report. It was saying that, in fact, there's also a trick where you phone up and you book a table for three people. And then when you get there, you say, oh, sorry, one of them's sick. And you do that so that you get a bigger table.
I know. Who's
that sad?
I am really sorry, but I did this myself in New York just a few weeks ago. But it was actually a sincere cancellation, and I felt sorry about that. Sometimes it matters more.
Did they look suspicious when you arrived?
Actually, the place, I think they knew exactly what was going on there. Yeah.
You booked for two and it was just you on your own, was it?
Yeah, pretty much. No, it was a few people.
Okay. Yep. Well, I'd like to say a big thank you to Bruce Palling and also to Marcus Hippie, who's the presenter of our Food and Drink Show, for coming here and joining me in the studio. And now, well, we're going to stay on the theme. We're going to have a bit of a song. And this is all in that kind of theme. I'm not sure if you really book for breakfast, but anyway, here goes. This is Kellis with Breakfast.
I want to say thank you.
Thank you.
You've been more than just a man. You've really been my friend.
Well, that was Kellis with Breakfast. I hope there would be at least the mention of a rasher of bacon in there, or a piece of toast, even a little old croissant. But there was no such hint. She even didn't mention her old milkshake. But there you go. That was her with Breakfast. And now we're going to cross over to New York, because in a change of pace, we're going to talk about some better things than that. Some more higher art, I think. We're going to talk about the world of art in New York and beyond. And we're joined today by the key critic, Shana Beth Mason. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And we're going to start with this Carl Andre exhibition, the sculptor. This is the first ever showing of his entire oeuvre for an institution, which is at the Dia. Can you tell us all about this?
What I can tell you about this retrospective, it actually coincided with his solo exhibition at the Paula Cooper Gallery in Chelsea. So this particular retrospective that's being held at DIA at the Beacon Foundation, which is just outside of Manhattan, it's called Carl Andre Sculptures Place. So it's 50 years of Carl Andre's most radical works, and as he's redefined minimalism and minimal conceptual or industrial art as we know it. When I went to see this exhibition in New York at the Paula Cooper Gallery, it just reaffirmed my suspicions of Andre as a master of reductiveness. And there were elements of brick, wood, steel that he had literally diluted down to its bare essentials.
And just tell me, what's the emotion you get from that? What's the experience for the person going to the gallery? What did you make of this as an experience?
Without reservation, I will tell you that I was told a story by a good friend of mine at Frieze New York, who was based in London, and I couldn't get the story out of my head. He had a floor corner piece that was made out of a series of rusted steel tiles. And I was recalling a story that she had told me about at Frieze Masters last year. The actor Benedict Cumberbatch had stepped on one of these floor pieces and literally pointed down and said, "What's that?" And she said, "Oh, it's just a Carl Andre." Oh. And I could not help but do the same thing and be very ginger about stepping on this floor piece. So I'm very sorry to all if I offended, but that's exactly what I did.
Now, he's quite notoriously picky about how his work is shown, and he accused a show at the Whitney back in 76 of mutilation when they showed his work. Is this an empathetic showing of his collection?
I would hope. Again, there's very little that you can determine from an artist's you know, own personal feelings about their work, especially when there are so many misconceptions that are strewn across so many decades. This is 5 decades of work, and it is indeed his first retrospective in North America since 1978, probably for that very reason. He's been very reluctant to show his work again for fear that it might be grossly misinterpreted, as it had done at the Whitney. And, you know, the Whitney is an incredible institution, and it's brought an incredible amount of respect to a lot of working artists, but they've had their share of falls, and perhaps this is one example of such.
Now let's move on. I don't know the artist, Shanique Smith. This is a show called Bright Matter, and it's at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and it's going to run through to March next year. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Shanique Smith, I was first introduced to her in Miami, actually. She had had a solo exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art, North Miami, soon to be the Institute of Contemporary Art. And she has also work that's held in the Margulies Collection at the Warehouse in Miami. And it's a hybrid of fabric, of sumi ink in very large gestural strokes. She's done film work. She's incredibly spread out across the medium spectrum. And she has this wonderful, very vibrant way of synthesizing these different materials into something that's urbanesque, and it's also it's very playful, but at the same time it recalls a lot of her own misgivings about the way that we interpret, you know, possible drawing patterns or pattern making. But to me, it's very lively and it's very colorful, and it doesn't beat about the bush.
Now, somebody who probably is a little less colourful, it'd be fair to say, is Adela Guerria. And this is another exhibition called Formulating a Plot, which is at the Perez Art Museum in Miami. Could you tell us also about this show?
I take great pride in talking about this show, since I'm originally from South Florida. And Adler Guerriere is someone who I've known for quite some time. He's a partner at the Dimensions Variable Nonprofit Artist Exhibition and Community Engagement Program, centered in downtown Miami, literally a stone's throw away from the new Perez Art Museum. And I think that his work that brings forward the spirit of what it's like to live in Miami and the metropolitan area, the colors, the splatters, the, you know, the pre-processed imagery, the natural settings that seem to consistently compete with the metropolitan surroundings. It's really, I think it all complements each other, especially in the unbelievable space that I had the opportunity to see while it was under construction. So it's, I think that it's a very appropriate local artist that is coming to the forefront with a very intelligent and a very well thought out exhibition that doesn't play to either strengths or weaknesses of the city, but it actually plays to different and a younger viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Shana. That was Shana Beth Mason from New York, but who gave us a good tour there of what's happening across the US in the world of art. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Xenia Wickett and Nina Schick. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Rowan Borshers, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next is Culture with Mr. Robert Bound. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.